and the Dallas mayor's wife. Plus, there were two police officers and a civilian who were on the ground, near the knoll. Those on or near the knoll tended to hear at least some shots from there, while others farther away reported one or more shots from the vicinity of the book depository. But even the number of shots witnesses reported, 2, 3, 4, even 5 or more shots, varied widely. Several witnesses near the knoll said they heard only 2 shots, perhaps indicating the number fired from there. It is an interesting parallel, investigator Josiah Thompson found, that, with no exception, all those witnesses who were deep inside the depository, either at work or in hallways, reported hearing fewer than 3 shots, either just 1 shot or 2. Several witnesses and officers did direct attention to the book depository. However, the depository had not attracted as much notice as the area behind the grassy knoll, and was not sealed off until 28 minutes after the shooting. A witness named Howard Brennan, whose statements to authorities would be very inconsistent, later became the star witness in making the case against Oswald. Though he initially appeared to have gone toward the knoll after the shots, he later claimed to have seen Oswald fire a shot from the depository. As Anthony Summers notes, Brennan couldn't identify Oswald in a lineup on the night of November 22, even though a month later he said he could, and then 3 weeks after that said he wasn't sure. Finally, Brennan told the Warren Commission he was sure he had seen Oswald in the depository window, even though Brennan's vision was questionable. The initial lookout for a suspect, apparently based on Brennan's description of the man in the window, was for a man older and heavier than Oswald. Dr. Gerald McKnight pointed out numerous other flaws in Brennan's testimony, rendering it worthless in placing Oswald in the sniper's nest. 2 other witnesses later said they saw a rifle being pulled back from a window in the book depository. One was Dallas Times-Herald photographer Bob Jackson, who would later win a Pulitzer Prize for his famous photo of Ruby shooting Oswald. The other was WFAA TV cameraman Malcolm Couch, who was riding with Jackson in the press car, 5 cars behind JFK. Couch said he saw about a foot of rifle being pulled back into the window. A shooter wouldn't need to extend the rifle out of the window at all in order to fire at JFK unless he wanted to call attention to his position. Neither Couch nor Jackson immediately contacted police about what he had seen, which even a Warren Commission counsel considered unusual, especially for a newsman. Within minutes of the shooting, Oswald had walked out of the building without being noticed, and if Oswald could leave the building without being noticed, anyone else could, too. According to most accounts, Oswald walked north 1 block, then turned right and went east on Pacific. He swung back to Elm Street and paused in front of the Blue Front Inn, 7 blocks east of the assassination site. He possibly boarded the Marsalis Street bus on Griffin Street. When the bus became stalled in traffic, Oswald asked for a transfer and got off the bus at the same time as another passenger. Oswald headed south on Lamar Street. He paused in front of the Greyhound bus terminal, 3 blocks from where he had left the bus. He took a cab, which drove southeast down Zangs Boulevard, and turned south onto Beckley. 12:35 to 1 p.m. In separate incidents, police arrested or detained 2 men at the Daltex building, across Houston Street from the book depository. Some researchers believe that 1 or more shots may have been fired from a window of the Daltex building near the corner of Elm and Houston, where the line of sight into JFK's limo would not have been obstructed by tree branches as it was from the depository. Some witnesses stated that when the shots were fired at JFK, they sounded as if they came from the direction of the Daltex building. One of the men arrested at the Daltex was a young man wearing a black leather jacket and black gloves. He was later released, and no records were kept of his arrest. The other man arrested at the Daltex was Eugene Hale Brading, a.k.a. Jim Braden, from Los Angeles. Brading was on parole at the time, and some authors have alleged that he was a courier for the mafia. Anthony Summers linked Brading to a gangster who knew Jack Ruby well and was an acquaintance of both Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante. Brading sometimes did business from the 17th floor of the Pierre Marquette building in New Orleans, and in his work for Marcello, David Ferry worked out of a different office on the same floor. Some of Braden's activities the day before the assassination parallel those of Jack Ruby. After giving police only his Jim Braden alias, Brading would be released within hours. In all, at least 12 men, possibly more, were detained by police, then released. In some cases, no records were kept about their detainment. In addition, some men from the book depository, besides Oswald, were questioned very closely by police. 12:35 p.m., approximately. Officer J.D. Tippett, who had been parked at a Texaco service station watching traffic, suddenly sped off towards Oak Cliff, according to three attendants at the station interviewed by former FBI agent William Turner. The station was located on the Oak Cliff end of the Houston Street Viaduct that the fleeing Oswald traveled in a taxi, just a few blocks west of the Triple Underpass in Dealey Plaza. 12:37 p.m. At Parkland Hospital, JFK was rushed into the trauma room, where faint signs of life were detected. The first doctor to see Kennedy, and the only one to see him before his clothes were removed, Dr. Charles J. Carrico noticed a small, round bullet entry wound, 3 to 5 millimeters wide, in his throat, above his shirt and tie. Other doctors soon joined Carrico, and they noted the huge head wound, which they estimated to be about 35 square centimeters. By the time the autopsy on Kennedy is performed that night, this wound will be described as 4 times bigger. In their later statements, they characterized this wound at the right rear of the head as an exit wound, indicating that the shot came from the front. At the small, round bullet entry wound in his throat, a neat tracheotomy incision was made. Also, external cardiac massage was performed. Emergency room doctors had no immediate need to turn Kennedy's body over, so they didn't notice the wound in his back. Connolly lay wounded in a second trauma room, a few yards away. JFK's limo was left unattended in the parking lot and was soon surrounded by people. Eventually, someone, apparently a Secret Service agent, started scrubbing the blood off the president's limo, unintentionally removing what would have been crucial evidence. 12:40 p.m., approximately. Jack Ruby was seen again at the Dallas Morning News building. Hugh Ainsworth, reporter, Dallas Morning News, told the FBI that shortly after Jack Ruby had been missed, people began to come to the office of the newspaper announcing the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and Ruby appeared shortly thereafter and feigned surprise at this announcement. 12:44 p.m., the Dallas police broadcast a description of the president's attacker, which sounded too old and heavy to be a good description of Oswald. White, 5 feet 10 inches, 160 pounds, 30 years old, armed with a .30 caliber rifle. 12:45 p.m. Officer Tippett was ordered into the Oak Cliff area of Dallas, though some consider the veracity of this transmission problematic, since it was missing from some early accounts of the Tippett incident. Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald lived in different parts of the small Oak Cliff neighborhood. 12:45 p.m., 1:45 Eastern Standard Time. J. Edgar Hoover called Robert Kennedy, who was having lunch at his home in Virginia, to tell him that, "The president has been shot. I think it's serious. I am endeavoring to get details. I'll call you back when I find out more." RFK called CIA Director John McCone at Langley CIA headquarters and asked him to come right over. It was only about a mile away. 12:50 p.m. Secret Service agent Forrest Sorrells, who was in the motorcade, arrived at the book depository after leaving Parkland Hospital. He was able to enter the rear of the building without presenting any identification. 12:54 p.m. Officer Tippett radioed that he was in the Oak Cliff area, and he was instructed to be at large for any emergency. 12:58 p.m. Police Captain Will Fritz arrived at the book depository after leaving Parkland Hospital. 28 minutes after the shooting, Fritz finally ordered the building sealed off. 12:59 p.m., approximately. Two men working at a record shop in Oak Cliff said Tippett hurried into the shop, made a call, apparently got no answer, and hung up after about a minute and rushed from the store. Dallas reporter Earl Goltz interviewed the two men, whose shop was one block from the Texas Theater where Oswald would be apprehended, and seven blocks from where Tippett would be killed. The men knew Tippett because he sometimes stopped in the store to use their phone. 1 p.m. Despite the extreme severity of the president's head wound, which left him no chance of meaningful survival, the Dallas doctors had done everything humanly possible to save him, but to no avail. John F. Kennedy received the last rites of the Catholic Church and was pronounced dead at Parkland Hospital. Chapter 15. Officer Tippett is killed and problems arise for Marcello. In New Orleans, at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, as are all times in this chapter, unless noted, Carlos Marcello and David Ferry were still in federal court waiting for the judge to begin his charge to the jury. While they had a perfect alibi for JFK's murder, it's ironic that they also had no way to know for sure what had happened in Dallas. It would be up to Guy Bannister, who was not in court, to monitor the news and field any reports from Dallas. JFK's death would not be announced for another 30 minutes, but by 1 p.m., Lee Oswald must have realized that things had gone horribly wrong. Yet Oswald may have felt that he still had a mission to complete. We may never know how much of that mission was real and how much had simply been made up or exaggerated by men like Ferry and Bannister. It most likely involved leaving work after lunch and going to a prearranged meeting at the Texas Theater as part of getting to Mexico and on to Cuba. As someone who had accepted the risks involved in defecting to Russia at the height of the Cold War, Oswald would have known the value of following orders and the danger of his current situation. At 1 p.m., in the Oak Cliff neighborhood of Dallas, Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper at Oswald's rooming house, saw Oswald run inside. Also at 1 o'clock, Dallas Police Headquarters radioed the patrol car of Officer J.D. Tippett, but he did not answer. At 1:02, Roberts saw a Dallas police car pull slowly up to the rooming house, park directly in front of it, sound its horn twice, and then slowly pull away. She said she saw two policemen in the car. However, ex-FBI agent William Turner points out that Tippett's uniform jacket was on a hanger in the car's window, and she could have mistaken that for a second officer. The housekeeper, who had poor eyesight, said she thought the car's number was 107. Tippett's number was 10. At 1:05 p.m., Roberts saw Oswald run out of the rooming house. Oswald had probably changed shirts to a long-sleeved, rust-brown shirt with a white T-shirt beneath it. He was also probably carrying a concealed revolver by this time. The housekeeper last saw him waiting at a stop for a bus that would take him back downtown. At 1:08, Tippett radioed headquarters, but headquarters didn't reply. Two witnesses at the Texas Theater, Butch Burroughs and Jack Davis, said they observed Oswald inside the theater as early as 1:15, according to researcher Larry Harris. He wrote that Burroughs, who was working the concession counter, remembered waiting on Oswald. However, sometime between 1:10 and 1:15, most likely around 1:12, Dallas police officer J.D. Tippett was shot at the 400 block of East 10th Street, between Denver and Patton Streets. As described by researcher Michael T. Griffith, the official Warren Commission story says that after Tippett saw a man who matched the description of JFK's assailant that had been broadcast over police radio, Tippett drove up slowly behind the man, pulled up alongside him, and then asked him to come over to the driver's window for what was described as having the appearance of a friendly chat. Oswald, the ex-serviceman turned killer, then pulled out his pistol, shot the officer, and fled. However, many other witnesses gave different accounts of Tippett's slaying. According to eyewitness Aquila Clements, Tippett was shot by a man who was kind of short and kind of heavy and wearing khaki and a white shirt. This man then motioned another man with him to go on. Another witness saw a man with a long coat ending just about at his hands, looking at Tippett's body, then running to his car, described as gray, 1950-51, maybe a Plymouth, and driving off. Also, most witnesses say that the man who talked with Tippett had been walking west, toward Oswald's rooming house, not away from it. Numerous problems with the evidence in the Tippett slaying have been noted for decades. For example, instead of immediately fleeing, the shooter took the time to empty four spent shells from his revolver at the crime scene. Two of the shells were made by Remington Peters and two by Winchester Western. However, of the four bullets taken from Tippett's body, just one was Remington Peters, and three were made by Winchester Western. There were also problems with the chain of custody of the shells, as well as with the initial descriptions of the gun itself and a discarded jacket. Noted journalist Henry Hurt pointed out that one of the oddest assumptions of the Warren Commission was that Officer Tippett stopped Oswald because he was able to identify him as the man described in the police broadcasts that started about 12:45 p.m. The description itself was of a white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, believed to be armed with a 30 caliber rifle. This description missed Oswald by 6 years and about 15 pounds. Michael Griffith points out that the police description could have fit a good quarter to a third of the male population of Dallas, and yet none of the witnesses who saw Tippett's assailant just before Tippett stopped him said the man was walking unusually fast or in any way acting strange or suspicious. Witnesses sometimes changed their stories, possibly because they were intimidated or threatened. For example, 2 days after the Tippett slaying, a policeman told witness Aquila Clemens that she might get hurt if she told anyone else what she saw, and she never spoke to the Warren Commission about it. As noted by Anthony Summers, witness Warren Reynolds was shot in the head 2 days after telling the FBI he could not identify Oswald, and after his recovery, Reynolds agreed he thought the fleeing gunman had been Oswald after all. The chief suspect in the Reynolds shooting was a heroin addict named Daryl Wayne Garner. Though Garner drunkenly boasted of the shooting and confessed to being at the scene, he was released when provided with an alibi by Nancy Mooney, a former employee of Jack Ruby. 8 days later, Mooney was arrested. She was later found hanged in her cell by her pants, presumably a suicide. Another Tippett-slaying witness, Domingo Benavides, was anonymously threatened after the Tippett killing, and his brother Edward was murdered by an unknown assailant soon afterward. Carlos Marcello's men in Dallas were very capable of having key witnesses intimidated or attacked. Aside from Clemens, the Warren Commission did not hear from two other important witnesses. According to researcher Larry Harris, Frank Wright, who lived on the next block, heard gunshots, went out to see what was happening, and saw a man standing near a police car. He insisted the man ran and jumped in a gray car parked beyond Tippett's car and sped away west on 10th Street. Jack Tatum told House Assassination Committee investigators that he had just passed a police car when the shooting broke out. Tatum paused and watched the gunman walk behind the squad car and take careful, deliberate aim before firing one more shot into Tippett. The House Select Committee on Assassination said, "This action, which is commonly described as a coup de grace, is more indicative of an execution, something one might expect of an experienced hitman." The key witness for the Warren Commission regarding Oswald and the Tippett slaying was Helen Markham. Larry Harris noted that while publicly the Warren report called Markham's testimony reliable, in private memos, the Warren staff said, "This witness is very unsure of herself on most points." Staff attorney Joseph Ball complained that her account was full of mistakes and utterly unreliable, and several years later, Ball derided Markham publicly during a debate, calling her an utter screwball. Warren attorney Wesley Liebler dismissed her story as contradictory and worthless. Even the Dallas Assistant District Attorney at the time, William Alexander, later told Anthony Summers that when it came to the Tippett slaying, Oswald's movements did not add up then and they do not add up now. No way. Certainly he may have had accomplices. And when Oswald went to the Texas Theater, was he supposed to meet someone, and did he miss a connection? Jack Ruby lived just a few blocks from the Tippett murder scene. Jack Anderson, one of America's top investigative journalists in the 1970s, later obtained information from Johnny Rosselli on several occasions. Anderson wrote that Oswald had to be killed because, according to Johnny Rosselli, underworld conspirators feared he would crack and disclose information that might lead to them. So Jack Ruby was ordered to eliminate Oswald. Before Ruby had to do the job himself, he apparently tried to persuade one of his many police contacts to kill Oswald. In fact, the night of Tippett's death, Ruby met with one of Tippett's police officer friends for more than an hour. According to Hurt, this officer had been working privately as a guard at an Oak Cliff home when Tippett was murdered nearby. Thousands of pages have been written just about the Tippett slaying, so we cannot cover here all of the evidence and the many problems with the theory of Oswald as a lone assassin of Tippett. The bottom line is that evidence and witnesses are so inconsistent that there are at least four possible explanations for his murder. 1. Oswald shot Tippett, just as the Warren Commission said he did. 2. Someone with Oswald might have shot Tippett. 3. While Tippett was talking to Oswald, the officer might have been shot by someone nearby who was unconnected with Oswald. 4. Oswald might have already been inside the Texas Theater at the time of Tippett's death, meaning the officer had been shot by someone else. At 1:22, officers on the scene of the Tippett shooting broadcast a description of the assailant, describing him as a white male about 30 years old, 5 feet 8 inches, black wavy hair, slender build, wearing a white jacket, white shirt, and dark slacks. William Turner cites Dallas police radio logs as saying that shortly after 1:41 p.m., Sergeant Hill came on the air. A witness reports that he, the Tippett suspect, was last seen in the Abundant Life Temple about the 400 block. We are fixing to go in and shake it down. On an alternate channel, Car 95 ordered, "Send me another squad car over here to 10th and Crawford to check out this church basement." However, another call came in, erroneously reporting that the suspect was at a library, where police converged. Suddenly, police were called to the Texas Theater, and the Abundant Life Temple was never searched. Reportedly, the temple had recently been the site of activity by Cuban exiles. According to the Warren Commission version, Johnny Calvin Brewer, the owner of a shoe store 6 blocks away from the slaying site, heard a report on the radio about the shooting. He looked up to see a man hide from a passing police car by stepping into his doorway. He followed the man, Oswald, who ducked into the nearby Texas Theater. Brewer alerted the cashier, who called the police. However, some researchers think that Oswald had been inside the theater since shortly after 1 p.m., either having bought a ticket or using a ticket someone had bought earlier and given to him. As noted earlier, witness Jack Davis said that once in the theater, Oswald sat next to him for a few minutes. Then Oswald moved to sit next to another person for a few minutes. Then Oswald got up and went to the lobby as though looking for someone. An alternate version proposed by some historians says that Oswald got worried when he couldn't find his contact, so he walked out to the lobby and looked around. He then went outside, onto the sidewalk, looking for his contact. Oswald saw a police car go by and ducked into the doorway of the shoe store, then went back into the theater to await his contact's arrival. In any event, police broadcast an alarm at 1:45 to converge on the Texas Theater. At approximately 1:48, police arrived at the theater, and once inside, the shoe store owner pointed out Oswald to the officers. However, Oswald was not the first person approached. First, an officer frisked 2 men sitting in the center of the theater before proceeding to Oswald. Did one or more of the policemen hope Oswald would make a run for it, allowing them to shoot the possible cop killer? Assistant DA William Alexander had gone to the theater and said the assumption at the time was that the person who killed Tippit had also killed JFK. Oswald was arrested between 1:51 and 1:55 after a scuffle. As noted by author Henry Hurt, there is conflicting testimony among arresting officers about just what happened during the arrest, and most of the dozen or so patrons scattered about the theater were never canvassed and questioned in any inclusive fashion by the FBI or the Warren Commission. Other evidence calls into question what ID Oswald had on him at the time, and whether an additional wallet was found at the Tippit slaying scene. The Warren report says that officers found a forged Selective Service card with a picture of Oswald and the name Alex J. Hiddell in Oswald's billfold. Author Sylvia Maher documented numerous problems with that claim, but that alias would soon be used to link Oswald to the rifle found on the sixth floor of the school book depository. At the Texas Theater, Oswald had something unusual with him, half of a box top, as if he were supposed to meet someone with the other half. As noted, Oswald had sat next to at least two people in the theater, then moved, as if waiting for them to say a coded phrase or produce the other matching half of the box top. Later, dollar bills torn in half would be found in Oswald's room, indicating he had used the matching half technique before. Antonio Veciana told my research associate how one of his CIA contacts, the CIA officer who originally recruited David Atlee Phillips for the CIA, used the technique of a torn-in-half dollar bill to identify his contact. CIA memos show they were using that technique in 1963 as part of the Amworld portion of the JFK Almeida coup plan. The matching half technique was also used by the heroin ring Michel Victor Meretz shared with Marcello and Traficante, most recently in a major bust that occurred in Laredo at the time of Oswald's return from Mexico. Recall that John Martino said that Oswald was supposed to meet his contact at the Texas Theater and then later be eliminated. Martino himself was emblematic of how the mob manipulated Oswald, since he was both a CIA asset and a mob functionary for Santo Traficante. Martino also knew Carlos Marcello. The use of movie theaters as clandestine meeting places for CIA missions was confirmed years later by David Atlee Phillips, the CIA officer Oswald had allegedly met with less than 3 months before the assassination. In his 1977 autobiography, Phillips described his own use of just such a technique, where he would meet a contact at a movie theater whom he'd know because he carried with him a previously arranged item and recognized a prearranged coded phrase. At 2 o'clock, Oswald arrived at the Dallas police station. He had $13.87 on him, and may also have had David Ferry's library card, as explained shortly. At 2:30, a police call went out to look for a 1957 Chevy sedan, last seen in the vicinity of the Tippit slaying. The alert said that the car's occupants should be checked for illegal weapons. Later, police searched Oswald's small apartment at the rooming house. In a C bag, they found a tiny Minox spy camera, three other cameras, a 15-power telescope, two pairs of field glasses, a compass, and a pedometer. There were also several rolls of exposed Minox film. A November 27, 1963 memo shows that David Morales' Miami CIA station used Minox spy cameras. At approximately 3 o'clock, police arrived at the home of Ruth Hyde Payne, where Oswald's wife, Marina, lived and Oswald had spent the previous night. 2 weeks earlier, Marina had noticed what appeared to be Oswald's rifle wrapped in a blanket in the garage. The police found the blanket empty. The case against the ex-serviceman who kept his rifle wrapped in a blanket and shot a patrolman on the street seemed cinched, except for one more important piece of evidence. The magic bullet, the cornerstone of the single bullet theory, required for one lone presidential assassin, was found at Parkland Hospital around 1:45, just before Oswald was arrested at the Texas Theater. This was the almost pristine bullet that supposedly caused JFK's back and throat wounds and all of Connally's bone-shattering injuries. According to Henry Hurt, citing medical reports, it literally shattered his fifth rib, leaving 5 inches of it pulverized, and then struck Connally's right wrist and shattered the radius bone at the largest point. All while, according to the Warren Commission's single-bullet theory, Connally continued to grip his white Stetson hat with that hand. The magic bullet then buried itself in Connally's thigh, from which it supposedly later fell out, emerging in almost perfect condition. Chapter 2 noted numerous problems that showed why the single-bullet theory was physically impossible, and the bullet most likely planted for a Parkland employee to find. Around 17 minutes before that magic bullet was found, Jack Ruby was at Parkland Hospital, where he spoke with noted journalist Seth Cantor. The time was approximately 1:28 p.m. Another witness also saw Ruby at Parkland around that time, though for some reason Ruby later denied being there. The police and the Warren Commission seemed desperate to pin Tippit's murder on the obvious suspect they had in custody, Oswald. According to author Larry Harris, the police lineups regarding Oswald and the Tippit slaying have been described as a travesty. In the first two, the disheveled and bruised Oswald was paraded before witnesses, including Helen Markham, accompanied by two detectives and a jail clerk who were neatly attired in slacks and dress shirts. The next day's lineup, viewed by Tippit witness William Scoggins, was even more outrageous. Oswald, two teenagers, and a Hispanic man. Despite that stacked lineup, Harris pointed out that an FBI report reveals that 2 days later, when FBI agents showed him a photograph of Oswald, Scoggins told them he couldn't be sure the person he observed on November 22 was actually identical with Oswald. At 1:33 p.m., White House press aide Malcolm Kilduff in Dallas officially announced that JFK was dead. 5 minutes later, at 1:38 p.m., CBS anchor Walter Cronkite told a national television audience the tragic news. It's often overlooked that just over a minute earlier, Cronkite had been telling his audience that, regarding the probable assassin, the sheriff's officers have taken a young man into custody at the scene. A man 25 years old, we are rep. Cronkite abruptly stopped describing the young suspect when he was handed a memo that confirmed JFK's death. Cronkite's emotional words reporting that the president was dead is an oft-repeated clip, but overlooked by most is that Cronkite's remark about the young man in custody didn't refer to the 24-year-old Oswald's capture at the Texas Theater. It couldn't have, since the newsman made his fateful pronouncement about JFK at 1:37 p.m., but the police weren't even called to the theater until 1:45, and the first officers didn't arrive until 1:48 p.m. In New Orleans, the trial of Carlos Marcello entered its final stages. At 1:30 p.m., Judge Herbert Christenberry had just delivered his 15-minute charge to the jury, according to John H. Davis, when a bailiff suddenly strode into the courtroom and handed the judge a note. After reading it, the shocked judge announced that JFK had been shot and might be dead. The judge handed the case to the jury and called for an hour's recess. For Marcello and David Ferry, that hour would be their first chance to find out more about what had happened in Dallas. Guy Bannister was not in his office that day, during regular business hours, so he was probably available to tell them whatever he'd learned. While all three would have been happy at JFK's death, the fact that Oswald was still alive and in police custody presented a huge potential problem. Court resumed session at 3 o'clock. However, Robert Kennedy's lead Justice Department prosecutor on the case, John Duguid, told me that while David Ferry had been in the courtroom with Marcello's team before the break, Ferry wasn't in court when everyone else returned. With remarkable speed, at 3:15, the jury delivered its verdict. The juror Marcello had bribed reportedly boasted later that not only had he voted not guilty, but he had also convinced several of his fellow jurors to vote not guilty. Just to be sure he avoided conviction, Marcello had also made sure the key witness against him was threatened during the trial. Consequently, the jury found Marcello not guilty on both counts of perjury and conspiracy. Marcello initially presided over a celebration of his victory, but Davis writes that Marcello left the party and went to his office at the Town and Country Motel, according to one source, looking as if he had something urgent on his mind. If Marcello didn't want to face far more serious charges than those he had just escaped, he had important loose ends left to deal with. In Washington, D.C., Harry Williams had returned from lunch to resume his meeting with the CIA officials. According to CIA Director John McCone's desk calendar, now at the National Archives, McCone had lunch that day, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Richard Helms, Lyman Kirkpatrick, and two other officials. By the time Williams' meeting resumed, everyone had heard that JFK had been shot. Williams told me that the highest official at the meeting at this time, apparently Lyman Kirkpatrick, began eyeing him with suspicion, as if some aspect of JFK's death made the CIA official think a Cuban exile was involved. Williams said he was trying to play it cool, but he felt that perhaps Kirkpatrick took his demeanor the wrong way. Within minutes, the meeting broke up, with all plans on hold, and Williams returned to his room at Washington's Ebbett Hotel. Someone in the presidential party in Dallas called Robert Kennedy at his Hickory Hill estate in Virginia to tell him his brother was dead. That was followed by a flood of calls from Lyndon Johnson, Hoover, and others over the four phones in RFK's large house. According to Richard Mahoney, while taking a break from the flurry of calls, Bobby confided to his press secretary, Ed Guthman, that, "I thought they'd get one of us, but I thought it would be me." Robert was apparently referring to the mafia. While CIA Director John McCone was en route to the estate, RFK made an intriguing call to CIA headquarters, according to journalists George Bailey and Seymour Friden. Friden was the New York Herald Tribune's foreign affairs editor, later revealed by Jack Anderson to have been a paid CIA informant in the 1960s. Friden said that RFK spoke to a high-level CIA official at headquarters about the shooting of JFK and demanded to know, "Did your outfit have anything to do with this horror?" After John McCone arrived at RFK's estate, probably between 2:45 and 3 Eastern Standard Time, Mahoney writes that Robert went out on the lawn with him. "I asked McCone," Kennedy was to tell his trusted aide, Walter Sheridan, "if they had killed my brother, and I asked him in a way that he couldn't lie to me, and McCone said they hadn't." Mahoney points out that McCone was one of Bobby's closest friends in the administration, and this extraordinary question revealed a deep and terrible suspicion about the CIA, something born of some knowledge or at least intuition, and not simply the incontinence of grief. Of course, neither McCone or RFK knew about the ongoing CIA mafia plots or the assassination side of the Kubela, AMLASH, and QJ Wynn operations. RFK's question likely referred to some aspect of the JFK Almeida coup plan that both men knew about, particularly the AmWorld portion with exile leader Manuel Artime. Not long after the assassination, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. notes, CIA Director McCone told RFK that he thought there were two people involved in the shooting. By 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, McCone was back at CIA headquarters, meeting with officials who knew about the JFK Almeida coup plan, including Richard Helms and Lyman Kirkpatrick. Helms told neither man that he had continued the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel, or that a CIA officer had been meeting with Roland Kubela about Fidel's assassination at the very moment that JFK was shot. In Paris, that CIA case officer had been meeting with Rolando Kubela, AMLASH. They had discussed Kubela's being provided with several items, including two high-powered rifles with telescopic sights. According to the Church Committee, the case officer tells AMLASH the explosives and rifles with telescopic sights will be provided. The case officer also offers AMLASH the poison pen device, but AMLASH is dissatisfied with it. As the meeting breaks up, they are told President Kennedy has been assassinated. In Havana, French journalist Jean Daniel was having lunch with Fidel Castro, discussing JFK's proposal for talks between the two countries. When Castro was informed of Kennedy's death, he said three times, "This is very bad." Other accounts have Castro saying, "This is very bad news." In Miami, Jimmy Hoffa called Frank Regano, the attorney he shared with Traficante, and gloated over the assassination of JFK. However, Hoffa's mood changed after he got a call from a Teamster official in Washington. Hoffa was furious that two Teamster leaders at the union's Washington headquarters had closed the office, lowered its flag to half-mast, and sent condolences to the president's widow. Hoffa yelled at his secretary for crying, hung up on the people in Washington, and left the building. In San Juan, Puerto Rico, FBI reports say a Teamster organizer told the secretary-treasurer of the local Teamsters Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, "We killed Kennedy." The Teamster organizer was an associate of Frank Chavez, a deadly henchman for Jimmy Hoffa. FBI reports also linked Chavez to Jack Ruby, and Chavez would later make a documented attempt to kill Robert Kennedy. Shortly before 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in Washington, D.C., reporter Haynes Johnson had joined Harry Williams in his room at the Ebbett Hotel. Williams had been helping Johnson with his forthcoming book on the Bay of Pigs. Haynes was also working closely with Manuel Artime on the book, even though at the time there was friction between Artime and Williams. Though Haynes was friends with both RFK and Williams, the journalist hadn't been told about the JFK Almeida coup plan. In the hotel room, Williams was on the phone with Robert Kennedy, who told him that the JFK Almeida coup plan was now on hold, so Williams wouldn't be leaving for Guantanamo the next day. Hearing that Haynes was also in the room, RFK then asked to speak to him, since he was also a friend of RFK's. As Haynes later wrote in a 1983 Washington Post article, Robert was utterly in control of his emotions when he came on the line and sounded almost studiedly brisk as he said, "One of your guys did it." Haynes didn't mention RFK's comment to Harry, and RFK never said anything about it or said anything similar to Williams. It's important to stress that both Haynes Johnson and Williams agree that RFK said, "One of your guys did it, killed JFK," to Haynes, not to Williams. Haynes confirmed that to me in 1992 and again in May 2007, and it's in his detailed 1983 Washington Post article. Williams said RFK never voiced any suspicion like that to him on that day or any other. A close Kennedy associate who knew RFK, Haynes, and Williams backed up Williams' statement. Though historian Richard Mahoney didn't know about the JFK Almeida coup plan when he wrote his 1999 book, he perceptively wrote that RFK's comment to Haynes Johnson clearly was referring to embittered Cubans deployed by elements of the CIA who might have been acting at a deniable distance. The evidence indicates that RFK's comment related to Manuel Artime's operations, which we now know had ties to associates of Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and Johnny Rosselli. That would also explain why RFK would make the "your guys" comment to Haynes and not Williams, due to the friction that had developed between Williams and Artime. Haynes Johnson would later write that within a year or so after JFK's death, he heard that Artime was involved in the drug trade, something that was later confirmed by U.S. officials. In addition, Haynes also wrote about one of Artime's protégés during Watergate, who became a major Miami drug lord when Traficante was still powerful there. At 4:01 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on November 22, 1963, only an hour after Oswald's arrival at Dallas Police Headquarters and just 10 minutes after J. Edgar Hoover learned Oswald's name, Hoover called Robert Kennedy and was able to tell him he thought we had the man who killed the president and that Oswald was not a communist. Hoover probably knew the latter because the FBI had assisted Naval Intelligence with its tight surveillance on Oswald. This information almost slipped out right after the assassination, when James Hostey, the Dallas FBI agent assigned to Oswald, allegedly told Dallas police officer Jack Revel on November 22 that Oswald had been under observation. When Revel protested that the information had not been shared with the Dallas police, he was reminded of the FBI policy forbidding the sharing of information pertaining to espionage. At 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, NBC News anchor Chet Huntley introduced the audio portion of Oswald's August 21, 1963 interview with WDSU-TV in New Orleans. By 7:43, NBC was running the video portion of the interview as well, allowing millions of viewers to see and hear Oswald state, "I would definitely say that I am a Marxist," and then outlining the aims of the Fair Play for Cuba committee. For many people, those comments cinched Oswald's guilt. Like Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante had a documented celebration the day that JFK was assassinated. Traficante had earlier arranged to meet his lawyer, Frank Regano, and Regano's girlfriend, Nancy Young, later Regano, for dinner at Tampa's International Inn. JFK had delivered a speech there just 4 days earlier, and the irony was not lost on Traficante or Regano, who realized that in the same hotel lobby I was crossing to meet Santo, Kennedy had shaken hands and waved at admirers earlier that week. Regano found the normally crowded restaurant almost empty that Friday night. He says that a smiling Santo greeted me at our table. "Isn't that something? They killed the son of a bitch," he said, hugging and kissing me on the cheeks. "The son of a bitch is dead." Regano noted that Traficante's generally bland face was wreathed in joy. As Traficante drank Chivas Regal, he proclaimed, "This is like lifting a load of stones off my shoulders. Now they'll get off my back, off Carlos's back, and off Hoffa's back. We'll make big money out of this, and maybe go back into Cuba. I'm glad for Hoffa's sake, because Lyndon Johnson is sure as hell going to remove Bobby. I don't see how he'll keep him in office." Regano said that Traficante talked more excitedly than usual, and it was unclear to me what he meant about returning to Cuba. Regano didn't realize that Traficante knew about the JFK Almeida coup plan and that the U.S. government had been making plans to invade Cuba for months. After a Traficante toast, Regano's girlfriend arrived. Regano says that when her drink came, Santo and I raised our glasses again, and Santo said merrily, "For 100 years of health and to John Kennedy's death." Then Traficante started laughing and began another toast. Horrified by the public spectacle, Regano's girlfriend banged her glass on the table and rushed out of the restaurant. Regano stayed with the jubilant Traficante, who continued toasting in Sicilian to the bountiful times he was certain were coming. Information uncovered after Regano's death suggests why he may have toasted the president's death so heartily. Regano may have had a small part in the payoff for the JFK hit. According to FBI reports, in December 1963, an FBI source witnessed a meeting between Santo Traficante, Frank Regano, and another Tampa mobster. The three argued over briefcases of money, with the mobster telling Traficante the money was short by $200,000 because of the payoff the mobster had already made to the two men who killed JFK. The source was a prison inmate who sent a letter to an assistant U.S. attorney in 1992, who then forwarded it to the FBI. The mobster he named was a business partner of one of Traficante's closest relatives. Also, the club in Tampa where the source said the meeting occurred was well known for being linked to the mafia. Confirmation for the meeting comes from the FBI file, which says that independent of the inmate, the FBI had already received information regarding an incident similar to that reported by the inmate. Around 5:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, J. Edgar Hoover issued an internal memo stating that police very probably had Kennedy's killer in custody, calling Oswald a nut and a pro-Castro extremist, an extreme radical of the left. Hoover soon began to exert pressure on senior FBI officials to complete their investigation and issue a factual report supporting the conclusion that Oswald was the lone assassin. Though it wasn't a federal offense for one person acting alone to kill a president, it was a federal offense for two or more people to conspire to injure any officer of the U.S. engaged in discharging the duties of his office. Thus, proclaiming Oswald the lone assassin kept it a local and not a federal prosecution, and it kept it out of the hands of Robert Kennedy's Justice Department. Hoover's early decision to pronounce Oswald a lone assassin, even before JFK's autopsy, no doubt signaled to many agents in the field how their investigation should proceed. There was a shift from agents pursuing every lead vigorously to focusing on Oswald's guilt and claiming he had acted alone. In addition, because of the quick decision that there wasn't a conspiracy, there was no large manhunt in Dallas for other conspirators. Roads and airports weren't closed, making escaping the city far less difficult for those involved in the assassination. There are unconfirmed reports of various private planes taking off from small airports around Dallas, particularly Redbird, but nothing conclusive. However, in New Orleans, the conspiracy would soon start to unravel. The mood at Guy Bannister's office had been joyous earlier on November 22. Though his temporary secretary said Bannister wasn't there at all that day, she said that Bannister's mistress, Delphine Roberts, was in the office. Roberts received a call to inform her that the president was assassinated and to turn on the TV. When Roberts turned on the TV, she jumped with joy and said, "I'm glad." After the secretary left, that evening Bannister finally made it into the office after visiting a neighborhood bar. He was preceded by Jack Martin, a private detective associate and drinking buddy of Bannister's. According to Delphine Roberts, Martin arrived first and went to a filing cabinet. Bannister soon entered and accused Martin of stealing files. They argued, and Martin yelled, "What are you going to do, kill me, like you all did Kennedy?" Bannister then pulled out a pistol and struck Martin on the head several times, causing him to bleed. Martin later called an assistant district attorney to say that Ferry was a longtime colleague and tutor of Lee Oswald. Since Martin had fallen out with Ferry over a fraudulent ecclesiastical order, the Holy Apostolic Catholic Church of North America, and was an alcoholic, there was some doubt at the time about his reliability. But Martin's actions would set off a chain of events that led to Ferry's arrest by Monday, November 25. However, on Friday evening, Ferry had more to worry about than just Martin's accusations. David Ferry's library card was apparently found on Oswald at the time of his arrest. According to an FBI report, Marcello's lawyer, G. Ray Gill, stated that he had gotten word that Lee Oswald, when he was picked up, had been carrying a library card with David Ferry's name on it. On Sunday, November 24, Gill would stop by Ferry's residence and leave word that Ferry should contact him, Gill, and he would represent him as his attorney. In addition, Gill said that Jack Martin had gone to the police and the FBI and said that Ferry had stated in his presence that the president should be killed. That was on Sunday, but according to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Oswald's former landlady in New Orleans, Mrs. Jessie Garner, told the committee she recalled that Ferry visited her home on Friday, the night of the assassination, and asked about Oswald's library card. In addition, a neighbor of Oswald's in New Orleans also said that Ferry had come by her house after the assassination, inquiring if her husband had any information regarding Oswald's library card. Within days, the Secret Service would ask Ferry whether he had ever loaned Oswald his library card, but on Friday, November 22, Ferry didn't want the authorities to connect him to Oswald in any way, so he took two young men with him on a sudden trip to Texas. David Ferry's travels and actions on the two-day trip were considered so bizarre and unusual by investigators that it's possible that his goal was to retrieve his library card. Ferry needed the card so that he could produce it if he were ever asked for it by investigators in New Orleans. Shortly before his death, Ferry told the staff of New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison that he had some business for G. Ray Gill to take care of when he suddenly went to Texas. Ferry told the FBI that he had been in New Orleans until at least 9 p.m. on November 22, celebrating Marcello's trial victory at the Royal Orleans Hotel. Ferry suddenly decided to drive to Houston through a heavy rainstorm, accompanied by two young men. They visited a Houston ice skating rink, where Ferry spent a great deal of time at a pay telephone, making and receiving calls, according to Anthony Summers. In the early morning hours of November 23, Ferry checked into the Alamotel in Houston, which was owned by Carlos Marcello. Congressional investigators confirmed that Ferry made a collect call to the Town and Country Motel, Marcello's New Orleans headquarters. He also called Marcello attorney G. Ray Gill that weekend. While still registered at the Houston Alamotel, Ferry drove to Galveston and checked into another motel there. Jack Ruby made several calls to Galveston around the time of Ferry's arrival there. Congressional investigators couldn't understand why hotels in Houston and Galveston both listed Ferry as staying there during the same 12-hour period. One explanation is that someone in Galveston or Houston may have been bringing David Ferry his library card. For example, there were men in each city who had just come from Dallas shortly before Ferry's arrival. One was an associate of Jack Ruby, and the other was alleged mob associate Eugene Hale Brading, who had been arrested in Dealey Plaza just after JFK's assassination. I'm not asserting that either of those two men delivered Ferry's card, but simply explaining how it could have been done. Guy Bannister might have been able to use his law enforcement or intelligence contacts to get someone on the Dallas police force to pull the card. Bannister could have evoked Ferry's work for the CIA and with Verona's CIA-backed anti-Castro Cuban group, giving rise to the "for the good of the country" excuse offered to Dallas reporters to stop their reporting on Ferry. Alternately, Marcello's associates might have been able to use their Dallas police contacts to get the card. Mobster Joe Civello ran Dallas for Marcello, and Dallas Police Sergeant Patrick Dean boasted to Peter Dale Scott about his long-time relationship with Civello. Sergeant Dean was also good friends with Jack Ruby. In fact, according to Scott, Dean would be in charge of security in the Dallas Police Department basement when Oswald was murdered, and later fail a lie detector test about Ruby's access to it. Homicide Captain Will Fritz, in charge of the Oswald investigation, was also very close friends with Jack Ruby, according to J.D. Tippett's attorney. According to Dallas FBI agent James Hostey, after JFK's murder in Dallas, the Pentagon ordered us to Defense Condition 3, more commonly known as DEFCON 3, the equivalent of loading and locking your weapon and then placing your finger on the trigger. The power cells within Washington were in a panic. Peter Dale Scott points out that Hostey wrote that at the time of Oswald's arrest, fully armed warplanes were sent screaming toward Cuba. Just before they entered Cuban airspace, they were hastily called back. With the launching of airplanes, the entire U.S. military went on alert. Scott notes that these planes would have been launched from the U.S. Strike Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. That was the very base that JFK had visited just 4 days earlier, for a secret session with the strike force commander and other leaders. However, the DEFCON 3 alert status soon diminished. U.S. News and World Report notes that the Air Force and the CIA sent a flash worldwide alert for all U.S. surveillance flights to return to their bases lest the Soviet Union be provoked. On Friday afternoon and evening, national security concerns about JFK's assassination reverberated throughout the U.S. government as information, misinformation, and possible disinformation about Oswald started to be uncovered. Scott points out a declassified cable from U.S. Army intelligence in Texas, dated November 22, 1963, telling the strike command falsely that Oswald had defected to Cuba in 1959 and was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. Later, even Hoover would erroneously tell Bobby Kennedy that Oswald went to Cuba on several occasions, but would not tell us what he went to Cuba for. It appeared that someone had fed disinformation about Oswald to the FBI and military intelligence, which served to incriminate him and focus attention on Cuba. Jack Ruby constantly stalked Oswald at the police station,